Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. Today we're joined by my McCall, sweetie, a rescue from 22 years ago. It's cold outside and she was shivering, so I brought her in here. So if you hear a little noise in the background, you'll know. Let me see if I can get up and you can see her. There you are, sweetie. You're on camera. So anyhow, she's generally quiet. In any case, today we have a lot to share. We pride ourselves in taking on important topics that the mainstream media gives very little time or attention to, and certainly no scholarship, no deep diving on their part. Well, we do the deep diving. So when we bring you information, you can follow up and get all the footnotes and resources by going to GaryNall.com or on Progressive Radio Network. Scroll down to where you see my notes and you can get them from there. How about a study from George Washington University? We'll be sharing that. It calls into question the importance of meat eating in shaping our evolution. We have a lot on health to share today, but more importantly, we have some videos. Why are these videos significant? Three of them. Because they're all based upon people who risked their careers, their reputations. They were all orthodox, all pro-vaccine, all pro-medicine. They are all from doctors using their skills to save lives. One's a nurse. She'll be the first one we're going to. And she is standing up. Now, you'll notice behind her all these other nurses. And you'll watch their heads, watch their facial expressions, because you can tell they're agreeing with her because she's telling the truth. Now, why isn't CNN? Why isn't the New York Times? Why doesn't a consortium of the mainstream media bring together a group of other nurses who say, you're a liar, nothing you're saying is true? Well, because they know it is true and they will not debate. You see no debates anywhere today. And yet the foundation of an open and free society is dialogue, civil dialogue, share differences. So we're bringing you that today because it could literally save your life. As you'll hear one doctor say, and this is after 40 years of practicing medicine in emergency room, in ICUs, that the hospital is the most dangerous place you could be. And because of how bad medicine's become. Also, you're going to hear today something that you would rarely hear unless you read Death by Medicine or watched the documentary on how medicine has taken over our entire healthcare system. And Big Pharma is behind that, and profiteering from people who own the hospitals is even behind that. All that is going to be discussed today. So we got a good show for you. But always on health and nutrition, you talk about those of you in this audience who've been vegetarian or vegan, boy, does this show you're on the right side of it. Quintessential human traits, according to George Washington University, we have large brains. And it first appeared in the Homo erectus nearly 2 million years ago. And this evolutionary transition towards human-like traits is often linked to a major dietary shift involving greater meat consumption, or so we're told. But a new study just out from the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences calls into question the primacy of meat eating in early human evolution. And while the archaeological evidence for meat eating increases dramatically after the appearance of Homo erectus, the study's authors argue that this increase can largely be explained by greater research attention on this time period, effectively skewing the evidence in favor of meat made us humans, the hypothesis. But Barr and his colleagues compiled published data from 9 major research areas in Eastern Africa, including 59 site level dating from 2.6 million to 1.2 million years ago. They used several metrics to track Homo carnivori, the number of sites preserving animal bones that have cut marks made by stone tools, the total count of animal bones with cut marks across sites and the number of separately reported levels. And the outcome shows that no, meat was not the primary source of the diet. And at one time it might have been. But when people realized that they could farm and they could eat seeds and berries, they could eat grubs, they were eating everything that they could. But then when they became more civilized, the diet shifted to a complex carbohydrate diet. You know, just something to share with you. Not that it's important, because a lot of people live with this idea that you got to have meat 3 times a day. In fact, once, long time ago, a person who was going to be in a championship, world championship fighter, boxer, came up to my farm. I was up there in the summertime, and he said, I want to train up here. You know, I want to be in the mountains. I want to do the road work on the hills. And your brother, Stephen, said this would be okay. And I said, it's fine. And but then I started seeing what he was eating, and he was eating meat 3 times a day. And I mean, large amounts of meat. And he was pretty, you know, stout, strong guy, needless to say. If you're going to go into the world championship boxing, you better be strong. In any case, I sat with him one day and I said, you do realize that it's not the meat that's going to help you nutritionally. It's the complex carbohydrates, the essential fatty acids. It is the nutrients that allow the cells to give you more energy, the mitochondria. Because when a fighter goes past about 6 rounds, you start to see the arms come down, you start to see the elbows in, you start to see the body bending. They're tired. Those muscles are aching because in the first rounds, you used up so much of your energy. And now you've got the backlash of that. You've got the acids building up in the cells. So I explained to him how to have more energy. And so we go out for longer runs. And then, but he wouldn't change. And then the fight came and he got knocked out. And early on. And he wanted to blame it on not having the right diet. And I said, well, become a vegan and you'll see how much more energy you have, how much more strength you have. And he did. And he did have that. No, he lost the fight because he was up against a much, much more skilled boxer. But it was lesson learned. So just remember, for all the athletes out there now who think you have to have meat and lots of it, you don't. If you want to have muscle, do your workouts, train the muscles, take your branched chain amino acids, take L-carnitine, coenzyme Q10, this will be a big benefit to you. I've been an athlete my entire life. I've been a world-class athlete. I haven't lost in any of the world games. 2 golds, silver. Would have won a 3rd gold, but one member of our 3-person team lost it in the last mile. But I've trained at least 100,000 people. Over 32,000 have done the New York City marathons or other marathons based upon a vegan-based, plant-based diet, and then proper supplementation, and then mindful meditation that you use in a race. But now, very common for athletes in all fields to do meditation and yoga, become vegans, because it's the amino acids you need. And you can get your amino acids in abundance from all kinds of plant sources. Those nuts that you're eating, or the beans you're eating, or legumes and grains, they're all filled with complete amino acids. So just something to think about. Because a lot of people live with this myth, you must have meat or you'll be shriveling. Well, no, Arnold Schwarzenegger is now a vegan. But think of a Mr. America, Mr. Universe, Mr. World, all vegans. Now, something else is important about aged garlic. Now, yesterday I mentioned that in Japan, one of the things they really have mastered is the science behind aged garlic and how it helps them with all these different illnesses, preventing it. It's used both as a preventative and it's used also as a functional medicinal. But now a new study shows aged garlic, that's a liquid extract, can reduce dangerous plaque buildup in the arteries. Now, every morning, I take a bottle, it's about this big, and I take 1/3 of it, just squeeze it, goes in the mouth, swallow it down, follow that with a little drink. The little drink will have some red, very important nutrients, like pomegranate and beets and other nutrients, because it creates nitric oxide. That clears up the arteries, increases blood flow, which expands blood flow to the brain, to the extremities, to the muscles, to the heart, and therefore helps your heart, helps prevent arterial and atherosclerosis. But that aged garlic is right in there. So let's just consider the importance. Now, mind you, this came from UCLA Medical Center. They found that the supplement aged garlic extract can reverse the buildup of deadly plaque and therefore prevent the progression of heart disease. That's according to an article just published in the Journal of Nutrition. And the research was done at the LA Biomed and found a reduction in the amount of low attenuation plaque, or what's called soft plaque, in the arteries of patients with metabolic syndrome who took the aged garlic. And metabolic syndrome, as you know, is characterized by obesity, hypertension, and other cardiac risk factors. So quite simply, take aged garlic liquid each day and keep alive. Prevent heart attacks and strokes. Also, from the University of Washington School of Medicine, something that also boosts muscle strength, and that is called urolithin. U-R-O-L-I-T-H-I-N. It also improves mitochondria, your energy factories in all your cells. Therefore, you have more energy. It's just an oral supplement intended to stimulate a natural body process. It promotes muscle endurance, gives you more energy, and more strength. That's the research. So it's called Urolithin A, and it can help improve or prolong your exercising, no matter what it is, biking, jogging, power walking, swimming, all right? And it's a byproduct of a person's gut bacteria in a diet consuming polyphenols found in pomegranates and berries and nuts. So once again, everything comes back to the benefits of a healthy, organic, plant-based diet. Because diet, age, genetics, and disease affect the makeup of our gut microbiome, people produce urolithin A at variable rates. And the compound also is produced and sold by dietary supplements, so it's easily to get. Just one more tool that we have to be healthier. Also, we've been talking about walking. Now, I just finished 2 weeks as a reunion with a group of people that ran or power walked the New York City marathons, and a lot of them. And we got together so people could be motivated, which they were, nice group of people, to get back into shape, get their body really pumped. So these people, when they did the marathons with me, were in their 20s and 30s. Now they're in their 50s and 60s and 70s. And there was, as they would acknowledge in our discussions, we did discussions on my tennis court. And I had everybody spin the lecture seated 20 to 30 feet apart. And they all had ionizers, and inside all wore masks and shields over their face, wore gloves, very sanitized, and take their temperature every day. Nobody got sick. If you try to really prevent infection, you can pretty much succeed. In any case, we did a lot of power walking. And in power walking, you're using more muscles than when you jog or run. It's safer. There's less opportunity for injury. So the University of California, San Diego said that walking may reduce type 2 diabetes risk for adults 65 and older. Well, we have a lot, millions of adults 65 and over who have either prediabetes or diabetes. So this could be a lifesaver. Simply stated, walking daily at a greater intensity than you would normally walk, meaning walking to where you're really breathing hard, can prevent type 2 diabetes among 70 and 80-year-olds, according to the first studies measuring steps and pace among this population. The more steps a person takes, the more intense, meaning the quicker you are, the lower your risk of developing diabetes. That's good. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Diabetes Care. Now, a key figure from the study is that for every 1,000 steps, your results showed a 6% lower diabetes risk in the population. Well, 1,000 steps, so let's say you do 10,000 steps in a day. All right, that's 60% lower risk just by itself. That doesn't include having a healthy plant-based diet that doesn't spike your blood sugar, meaning you don't have all those, let's say you don't have all the sugars in the diet. That's important. Then you have a 100% risk-free program. So just remember, what that means is if the average older adult were to take 2,000 more steps every day, quickly, not slow. Slow is junk, what we call junk miles. It's not going to help you. Then in addition to what they are already doing, you might expect a 12% reduction in diabetes from just 2,000 extra steps. That's not a lot of extra steps. All right? So you go out there and you do 4 miles a day power walking, you're really helping extend your lifespan. And one other study to add on to the one I gave yesterday about fish oil. This is from Jizheng University in China. Fish oil and vitamin B12 together will lower your plasma homocysteine level. Now, we knew that B12, vitamin B6, folic acid, and vitamin C lower your homocysteine. These are measurements of inflammatory markers. When they're elevated, let's say 15, 14, 16, you're at a higher risk, sometimes even 100% higher risk, 200% higher risk of having a heart attack or stroke, and you wouldn't know it. That's why I suggest at least 3 times a year, get your homocysteine checked and your fibrinogen and your C-reactive protein. It's not an expensive test, easy to do, all right? But now, from the Asian Pacific Journal of Clinical Nutrition, they found that taking the B12 with the fish oil even lowered it more, and it also lowered your C-reactive protein, which is a major risk factor for heart disease. So again, how simple is that? B12, let's say, one milligram of B12, and then 2,000 milligrams of fish oil. Not bad, right? So that is our latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break. When we come back from the break, we're going to hear from a nurse. She has got her facts right. Her name is Nicole Sirotic, S-I-R-O-T-E-K. She's testifying before a congressional committee moderated by Senator Ron Johnson. Now, again, I don't care what else Ron Johnson's politics are. It's irrelevant. But what I do care, he is the only member of Congress who has brought together hearings to allow highly respected orthodox. None of these are alternatives. And by the way, just so you know, in the last 2 years, I have not invited a single alternative doctor on to talk about alternative approaches to COVID, because I wanted everyone in this audience, including people who may be in relationships with someone who's skeptical, family members who don't believe in any of this, and that's fine, to understand that you're hearing from your doctors only. You're hearing from the top doctors. You're hearing from the most respected doctor in their field, the top cardiologist, the most published author cited on PubMed in the world, in history. Yeah, he's the one we've invited on. All of these, the person, Dr. Malone, who was the founder of the science that allowed this vaccine to exist, pro-vaccine, he's vaccinated also. So this is not about whether you're pro or anti-vaccine, and that's how ingenious the opposition, the deep state, in the medical community and pharmaceutical industry is. It's made it look like if you've not taken the vaccine for any reason, you're the enemy. You're no better than a domestic terrorist. You're a danger to us. Where the other scientists, who are all pro-vaccine, their whole careers, will say, I'm pro-vaccine, but look at the science behind this. All the original statements, it's safe and effective. No, when the evidence came in, it was not safe. It's killed tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Americans. And it sure as hell injured a lot of people, many of them permanently, over a million. That's just in the United States. The numbers are even worse in other countries. Taken together, this is a massive, massive assault against reason, common sense, and real science. So why is it that even on Pacifica, how many producers on Pacifica who are intelligent and want to see their audience well-informed, why aren't they taking this on? Why aren't they doing their homework? Why haven't they interviewed Nicole and challenged her? Listen to my interviews. I don't do softball interviews. I do hard interviews. Why don't they do that? What are they afraid of? To find out that they've been wrong? To find out there's another truth that they have not availed themselves of? So we're going to go to her now. Mind you, she's speaking at a congressional hearing just on Monday of this week. And then ask yourself, based upon what she knows and all these doctors know who work in the front line, who work in the emergency rooms, and my goodness, has the American media played you? But they wouldn't have done it knowing the facts. They would have done it because they were told to do it. Who's telling them to lie? Where your life is at risk. And by the way, did you see that story yesterday about the person who needs a heart transplant? He's on a list. He's about to get it. And they denied him his heart transplant because he wasn't vaccinated. Wow. Now think of it. Any transplant in anyone, you have to depress the immune system. All right? You can't be taking all the vitamins that would stimulate the immune system. And they're giving him a known overstimulator of the immune system. As I told you from the beginning, we can expect to see a huge number of Americans and people around the world who seem okay after the vaccine. But 6 months, a year, 2 years from now, they have overwhelmed their immune system. Now the immune system is destroying you and the organs, and you'll have organs shut down. That's happening now and increasing. But if you were to have a heart transplant, no doctor, they shouldn't practice medicine if they recommended a vaccine of any kind. And yet, no one asks the deep questions. These people do. This is a place to get the truth. Back in a moment with that.
Thank you, Senator, for giving me an uninterrupted opportunity to represent the harm that is coming to the patients in the American hospitals and the lack of early intervention. My name is Nicole Sirotek. I'm a registered nurse. I've been a registered nurse for over a decade. My specialty is critical care, trauma, and flight. Since the start of the COVID pandemic, I've actually been rebranded, I guess you can say, as a leading expert in early intervention strategies executed on a large mass scale using the FLCCC protocol, as well as COVID patient ventilator protective strategies to optimize COVID patients on the ventilators. My story actually begins back in May of 2020. I was one of the original nurses that went to NYC to help with the COVID pandemic, because as we remembered, they needed nurses. Most importantly, they needed ventilators. Well, I was the whole package, a flight nurse that can manage ventilators. And when I arrived there, the gross negligence and the medical, malfeasance that happened in there and the complete medical mismanagement of these patients is what has led us to the situation that we're in right now. The pandemic and the hysteria that was created from poor public health measures and poor execution of appropriate early intervention strategies and the handicapping of medical professionals doing their job has led to where we are right now and into the crisis situation that we are in. I will use several key case studies that will represent larger descriptive statistical information for what I'm going to speak of. But when I was in New York, and what continues to happen today is that many of them are not dying from COVID. Now, many people don't know about me is that I'm actually a master's prepared biochemist, and I have worked extensively with the HIV virus tracking genetic mutations. So I feel very comfortable going toe-to-toe with some of these doctors here, although I am not a doctor, I'm just a nurse. But what we saw in these front lines, we knew what was happening. And when we asked for the ibuprofen, they said, no, it was contraindicated. When we asked, like, why aren't we giving them steroids? Oh, well, it's not. We're just following orders. Following orders has led to the sheer number of deaths that has occurred in these hospitals. I didn't see a single patient died of COVID. I've seen a substantial number of patients die of negligence and medical malfeasance. When I was on the front lines of New York, I'm unfortunately known globally viral as the nurse that was in the break room sobbing, saying that they were murdering my patients. The pharmaceutical companies had gone into those hospitals and decided to practice, I guess you can say, on the minorities, on the disadvantaged, on the marginalized populations that we know that we had no advocates for. Because the very agencies that should have been protecting them were closed because we were sheltering in place. Now, while I was there and I saw that the pharmaceutical companies were rolling out remdesivir onto the patients, I tried to get a hold of the IRBs, I tried to get a hold of my appropriate chain of command, I tried CMS, I tried Department of Health, and they rolled out remdesivir onto a substantial number of patients for which we all saw it was killing the patients. And now it's the FDA-approved drug that is continuing to kill patients in the United States. As nurses, we've collected a statistical or descriptive amount of information that you may not get from the doctors, because for more they do quantitative data, we do qualitative data with a humanistic, phenomenological approach in nursing research. And so we've collected the data from all of these patients across the country from which we have been helping patients, because I formed the organization American Frontline Nurses and the Advocacy Network so nurses could advocate for these patients. And all of this data pool shows that as these patients get remdesivir, they have a less than 25% chance of survival if they get more than two doses. Now they're rolling it out on children as well and into the nursing homes or skilled nursing facilities as early intervention, when, as Dr. Pierre Corey and Dr. Merrick have already demonstrated, that there are cost-effective medications out there, and we are going to see the amplification of death across our country. And we haven't even touched on the vaccines, for which all of our expert panels have already very well described that situation, so I won't touch on that, since many of them are by far superior to me than even I could ever hope to be. But I can tell you that 2 days ago, I flew out my first 10-year-old with a heart attack, and I had to fight the doctor in the ER because he's like, 10-year-olds don't have heart attacks. And I argued back and forth for 30 minutes to force his hand to get an EKG, to find out that he had almost a complete STEMI, which is ST elevated myocardial infarction, for which you could see it lit up on the 12-lead EKG. And he's like, well, that's not possible. And I'm like, well, he was just vaccinated yesterday. It is very much possible. At any given time, people are getting a hold of me and the nurse advocates at American Frontline Nurses to help advocate, because as you've seen, there is victim shaming that it's anxiety, oh, it's this. But in actuality, if they put down that it was a vaccine injury, the physician, the corporation, the hospital, the clinic, they actually won't get reimbursed, so it gets labeled as anxiety or neuropathy or Guillain-Barré syndrome, when in actuality, it's very realistically a vaccine injury. Now, I'm not, even though I founded American Frontline Nurses, I've traveled extensively to South America, India, and South Africa, working in hot zones, stopping the spread of the virus, and working with early intervention. And nowhere in those countries, in developing nations, do I see these issues that we see here in the United States. It's actually, I'm a very proud American citizen. I come from a family of immigrants, and my mother told me that the United States is the best country in the world, though granted I am biased being an American. And our level of healthcare has been deteriorated to substandard third world nation healthcare. Whereas I tell people, you are better off in South America in a field hospital than you are in level one trauma designer hospitals in the United States. As nurses, we are getting reports across the country from our American frontline nurses about patients not getting food, patients not getting water. How come a patient hasn't been fed in 9 days? Why do I need to get a court order to force a hospital to feed a person who isn't intubated and who's literally telling you they would like food? Oh, well, you can't take your BiPAP mask off. Well, that's what us nurses are for. We're going to help you take that off and we're going to help you eat, but we're not allowed to. If you know, if they're on a ventilator, they're not getting basic standards of care. I've had patients that haven't been bathed, haven't been fed, haven't been given water, haven't been turned. And if you ask me, this isn't a hospital, this is a concentration camp.
That's right.
Absolutely it is. Nowhere in the United States do we isolate people for hundreds of hours at a time with no human contact. It's not even allowed in the prisons. You are not allowed to isolate a prisoner for beyond a certain extensive amount of time because it is horrible for their mental health and is considered inhumane. However, in these hospitals now, we're allowed to isolate patients from their families for days, and you have to say goodbye to them over an iPhone, as Jennifer Bridges has just demonstrated to us, or she has to shuttle people in to see. And personally, I was fired for sneaking a Hispanic family in to say the last rites to their family. And so thank you, Senator Johnson, for giving nurses the opportunity to come and represent our patients, because as you can see, we're not often thought of as leading professionals, though we are the missing link between the doctors and the patients. So thank you so much for this time.
There are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of nurses who've seen the truth. And we appreciate those who've had the courage to come forward. Almost all have been punished, lost their jobs. What does that tell you about someone who is willing to lose their livelihood, have no certainty of another future, because they haven't been trained in other things? They've been trained to be a nurse, have dedicated themselves to saving your life, and now they're being purged. All right. Now we're going to go to another clip. We have two more clips to show you. They're going to go back to back. And this is from a 5 hours of people giving testimony. These are segments from different doctors. I wanted you to see and hear these doctors, because I'm going to be showing you doctors you may not have heard of before. Mainstream Orthodox doctors, they'll tell you about their background, but they're going to tell you about the horrors of censorship and how draconian, that it's a police state, absolute police state medicine today. And it's failing everyone. It's failing the patients first. It's failing the doctors, the nurses, the families. All right? But it's profiting up to $100,000 per COVID patient, as long as you label it COVID. But if you label it COVID and it was a heart attack that a person died from, but you label it COVID, the hospital, which means Wall Street, which means equity firms, they get that $100,000. And the person gets flowers. Well, no, they don't get flowers. I forgot. That would be too humane. Now to the next clip.
Thank you, Senator, for that introduction, for this opportunity to speak. I want to talk about medical ethics, because I'm concerned that many of our pandemic policies have ignored foundational principles of medical ethics. During the initial lockdowns in 2020, hospitals sat empty for weeks. Hospital staff, and including doctors, were even sent home as we had canceled surgeries and other procedures and were waiting for an influx of COVID patients that did not arrive until months later. Healthcare systems, spurred by perverse payment incentives from CMS, Dr. Merrick averred to just one of those, there are several others, caused our healthcare systems to focus narrowly on one single disease. This had the effect of, for example, biasing our COVID hospitalization and death counts. We've heard quite a bit about that in the media in the last couple of weeks, but people in this room have known about that for 2 years. We effectively abandoned patients that were suffering from other conditions and had other medical needs. The disastrous fruits of this myopia include an unprecedented 40% increase in all-cause mortality among working-age adults, 18 to 64, over the last year, most of which, two-thirds to three-quarters, depending on the state, was not related to COVID. Actuaries tell us that a 10% rise in all-cause mortality is a once-in-200-year disaster. This was a 40% rise. Our public health establishment has no answer for what caused that. The ethical principle of free and informed medical consent, guaranteed by the Nuremberg Code, the Helsinki Declaration, the Belmont Report, commissioned by our own federal government, the common rule in federal law, this basic principle of medical informed consent was abandoned. For example, when vaccine mandates required experimental EUA vaccines. The common good argument to get vaccinated in order to protect others quickly fell apart with clear evidence that the COVID vaccines do not prevent infection or transmission of the virus. Yet these one-size-fits-all mandates for vaccines remained. Meanwhile, public health authorities ignored natural or infection-induced immunity, even though this remains our primary path out of this pandemic, especially as vaccine efficacy declines with time and with new variants, as we've seen clearly with Omicron. Transparency, which is a central principle of public health ethics, was likewise abandoned. Along with several colleagues, some of whom are in this room, I had to file a FOIA request to obtain the Pfizer vaccine clinical trial data from the FDA, which the FDA is required under federal law to release on the day in which this vaccine was authorized. The agency came back saying that it wanted 75 years to release this data, the data for the vaccine that had been mandated for millions of Americans. Data that took the FDA only 108 days to review. Fortunately, the federal judge just ordered this data released in 8 months. Thousands like me have lost our jobs for declining a novel injection whose safety and efficacy data still remains hidden. My firing from the University of California, where I served for 15 years, my entire professional career, as a professor in the School of Medicine and director of their medical ethics program, came shortly after I challenged the constitutionality of the university's vaccine mandate in federal court, a case that's ongoing. The scientific method also suffered by a repressive academic and social climate of censorship and silencing of competing perspectives that we've heard a little bit about already. I certainly experienced that at the university. This projected to the public the false appearance of a scientific consensus, a consensus that was often very strongly influenced by economic or other political external interests. Finally, our government and public health authorities have still not defined the thresholds for this state of emergency that is renewed every 3 months. The supposed legal justification, this state of emergency, this public health emergency, for all the burdensome COVID countermeasures, right, a term that's emerged in the last few months with the militarization of public health. This is not a medical term. Physicians, scientists don't talk about COVID countermeasures. But these COVID countermeasures, the infringements on our civil liberties, the censorship of dissenting voices, all justified supposedly in the name of a public health emergency, the criteria for which has never been clearly defined. The assumption of emergency powers by both elected officials and unelected bureaucrats therefore continues indefinitely, with no end in sight, without any critical scrutiny or appropriate checks and balances. Thank you. The CDC and other public health agencies have given two reasons for avoiding acknowledging natural immunity in terms of their vaccine rollout policy. So I'll mention those two, and then I'll mention a third that I think is also operative. The first worry, and I served on the Orange County Vaccine Task Force. I helped the University of California develop our vaccine allocation policy, not the vaccine mandate. They didn't consult their own bioethicists on that policy, but I was involved in vaccine rollout policy and ethical questions about who should get the vaccine first when the supply of vaccine was insufficient to meet the initial demand. You remember in the early days, you know, who gets in line first, who gets it first. One worry that public health officials have mentioned is, well, if we acknowledge that natural immunity is a reality, which of course it is, and it's been epidemiology and immunology 101, they're worried that people would go out and deliberately get COVID rather than getting the vaccine. But of course, the issue around acknowledging natural immunity is, what about the people who already have had COVID? That's what we're talking about here, right? And we can give people advice on, you know, avoiding infection and so forth, but ignoring all the folks that have already recovered from COVID is not a good public health policy. The second worry was it was going to decrease the efficiency of a needle in every arm, right? If we have to ask people if they have had COVID or have them bring medical records or run a lab test to verify antibodies or T cells, that may slow down what we want to be a hyper-efficient process. And of course, the response to that is don't put the burden of proof on the people responsible for giving the vaccines. Just simply put the burden of proof on the individual recipient of the vaccines. If they want to decline the vaccine and cite natural immunity, then, you know, they can go get the test. They can go to their physician.
Until they were mandated to get the vaccine.
Right. Well, so that's the issue. And I've been interested in this because my lawsuit against the University of California's mandate is precisely on behalf of people with natural immunity. The third reason that went unspoken, but I think is absolutely undeniable, is that acknowledging natural immunity would lead to the next very basic question: how many people have it? And the fact that 2 years into the pandemic, we still do not know exactly how many Americans have had COVID is it's an astonishing failure of public health to do basic epidemiological research. The two most basic facts that every medical student learns first about every new illness that they learn about are incidence and prevalence. How many new cases and how many total cases over a given period of time, right? So let's run population-based randomly sampled T-cell testing or ongoing antibody testing to find out each month how many Americans and in what regions have already had COVID. Seems rather obvious. Well, if we do that, we're gonna find that, you know, prior to Omicron, it was probably over 50% by most estimates. After Omicron, many people are estimating 70% or more have had COVID. The public health establishment was afraid of those numbers because they would see it, rightly or wrongly, as an admission of policy failure. Why is that? Well, the lockdowns, the masks, the mass vaccination campaign, all of this was supposed to stop the spread of this virus.
Now we have another clip. And remember, all of these doctors have either lost their license, lost their opportunity to practice, been rejected by the hospitals where they were for decades, not because they did anything that harmed the patient, they didn't, but because they weren't willing to stand by and do nothing as if the patient could not be helped when all of the scientific evidence everywhere in the world shows that doctors should get involved at the very first steps in the disease process, because then they can control it, mitigate it, frequently eliminate it, or lessen its symptoms. That is a crime against humanity. That means that the lawyers should come in droves and sue everyone, including the newspapers and Fauci and everyone else involved. We're about to see that happen right now. Now to the hearings.
Thank you, Senator Johnson, and it's a privilege to be here with my esteemed colleagues. So, as you said, I'm a critical care doctor. I've practiced in the ICU for 35 years until recently, and until my job was terminated. I've been treating COVID patients in the ICU since March of 2020. I've treated hundreds and hundreds of COVID patients. So what I need to tell you is that between 4 to 10% of symptomatic patients with COVID-19 have required hospitalization across the world. With Omicron, it's about 2%. In this country, 4 million patients have been hospitalized with COVID, and of those, 850,000 poor souls have died. 850,000 people have died. These have been unnecessary, needless deaths. The NIH guidelines for the treatment of hospitalized patients for COVID include remdesivir and low-dose dexamethasone. Consequently, almost every single patient in this country, almost every single patient in this country is treated with the combination of remdesivir and low-dose dexamethasone. The PALM study group investigated 4 drugs for the use of Ebola. The results were published December the 12th, 2019 in the New England Journal of Medicine. And that date is particularly important because that signaled the beginning of COVID. The Data Safety Monitoring Board of that study terminated the study of remdesivir, terminated, because remdesivir increased the risks of death and renal failure. It was such a toxic drug, the Data Safety Monitoring Board terminated the use of remdesivir. Yet, in January and February of 2021, the NIH and the ACT-1 study enrolled patients in a study looking at remdesivir for the treatment of COVID-19. The last patient was enrolled April 19, 2020. 10 days later, before the study had actually terminated, Dr. Fauci sat in the Oval Office of the White House and he said the trial was good news. What Dr. Fauci did not tell you was that the primary endpoint of the study was changed halfway during the study. We all know that is scientific misconduct. Because the study was not going to be positive, they changed the primary endpoint. The original endpoint was an 8-point ordinal scale that included death and a requirement for mechanical ventilation. Knowing that remdesivir would not affect those endpoints, they invented a bogus endpoint called time to recovery, which they showed in this study was statistically significant. And based on this bogus endpoint, remdesivir was approved by the FDA on October the 20th, 2020. So if one does a meta-analysis looking at the studies of remdesivir, the 2 studies which were sponsored by Gilead show a reduction in mortality. However, if you look at the 4 independent studies, including the large study by the WHO, it shows the opposite effect. Remdesivir increases the risk of death. Let me say that again. Remdesivir increases the risk of death by 3%. It increases your chances of renal failure by 20%. This is a toxic drug. But just to make the situation even more preposterous, the federal government will give hospitals a 20% bonus on the entire hospital bill if they prescribe remdesivir to Medicare patients. The federal government is incentivizing hospitals to prescribe a medication which is toxic. So it should be noted that remdesivir costs about $3,000 a course. Dr. Corey spoke about ivermectin. Ivermectin reduces the risk of death by about 50%. It costs the WHO 2 cents. 2 cents. So as regards dexamethasone, this is the wrong drug in the wrong dose for the wrong duration of time. Yet every clinician in this country will absurdly use this homeopathic dose of dexamethasone. Why? Because the NIH tells them to do this. So what the NIH and other agencies have ignored are multiple FDA-approved drugs. These are FDA-approved drugs. These are not experimental drugs, which are cost-effective and safe and have unequivocally been shown to reduce the death of patients in the ICU and in hospital. For example, there are 25 high-quality, so people complain about the quality of these studies. So if you select out the high-quality randomized controlled trials, they show that ivermectin reduces the risk of death by 26%. This is an extremely safe and cheap drug. In fact, it is one of the safest drugs on this planet. You are more likely to die from taking Tylenol. You are more likely to die from taking Tylenol than ivermectin, yet the FDA calls this a dangerous horse deworming medicine. So we have a whole host, as Dr. Uso and other clinicians have said, there are a whole host of drugs that have been proved highly effective for the treatment of hospitalized patients, including antiandrogen therapy, spironolactone, fluvoxamine, nitazoxamide, melatonin, vitamin C, and I can go on. So the question is, why? Why have cheap, safe, and effective drugs been ignored for the treatment of COVID-19, which could have saved maybe 500,000 lives? And I think Dr. Corey has told us exactly why. Thank you.
Thank you.
The most important factor in determining progression of disease is symptoms is viral load. The viral load in your nosopharynx is really important. So that's where the ACE2 receptors are. That's where the virus replicates. Many factors affect the viral load, as we heard, secretory IgA. But it kind of makes sense if you know where the virus is, kill it where it is. Kill it. And we have oropharyngeal and nasal sprays that will kill the virus within 5 seconds. Why aren't we doing that? I travel with my own little nasal spray because I don't know when I'm going to be infected. I sprish it in my nose. It is a simple, cost-effective way to control the virus. Just squish this in your nose. Okay, well, the NIH tells you to go home, take fluids, take Tylenol, and you stay at home until you get blue, and you can't breathe, and then you go to hospital, and then they isolate you like a prisoner, give you remdesivir and dexamethasone, and then you die. That's the NIH recommendation.
No, we'll get to that phase.
So obviously what we're saying, and Dr. McCullough has said this, and all we've said, this is a treatable disease. COVID-19 is a treatable disease. But what's critical is timing because of this viral load. You treat early. You don't wait for the test. When patients have symptoms of COVID, you treat them like they have COVID. And there are effective treatments to treat them.
So I can address this personally because this is a personal issue for me. So just to make the point that what's happening now is completely unprecedented in the history of medicine and across the world.
Do you remember? Almost 2 years ago, I was suggesting early treatment. I even did an entire protocol. I wrote 4 articles on how to have a prophylactic, preventative protocol, and one a therapeutic protocol. How many people are alive in this audience who contracted COVID and you did that protocol instead of waiting until their lips turn blue? You're just hearing from some at a congressional hearing that the new mainstream media will not cover. Now, remember I said, always spray colloidal silver in your nose because you're going to kill the virus in the nose, and then take Manuka honey when you're on a trip and put it in the back of your mouth. I also said to rinse with something I would normally never suggest you rinse with, but in this case, it could save you from being infected. That's Listerine, full strength for 60 seconds. You'll feel like your mouth is on fire, but that's giving you protection. All right? Just simple things that we could do that the media mocked and ridiculed. Some good news. Last week, at the end of the week, I introduced a new product I've been working on for a long time. Almost all vitamin C in the world comes from ascorbic acid. And then what you do with that ascorbic acid enhances it, buffering it, adding in the ascorbates and bioflavonoids, etc. But I want to see how powerful a vitamin C I can make without ascorbic acid, but rather with natural sources. Then I had to study all the natural sources in the world. And the measurement of how effective anything's going to be when it comes to antioxidants and stopping free radicals. Remember this, free radicals are the cause of a lot of problems. So if you can neutralize the free radicals, and that's what vitamin E does, vitamin C, bioflavonoids, about 20 different things easily does that. And so I put together a new compound, brand new. And it is a natural sourced Supremacy Extra. And in that, what is really important that people may be clueless about is ORAC, O-R-A-C, 11,000 units. Now this goes with the Amla, Acerola, Cockatoo Plum, Camu Camu, Grapeseed Extract, Green Tea Extract, and Pomegranate Extract. So this is one powerful thing. But what I want to explain to you today, to give you a little deeper understanding of why this is quite simply, in my opinion, the finest vitamin C in the world, is because of ORAC. ORAC is a measurement used to quantify the overall antioxidant power in foods, particularly vegetables and fruits, nuts and grains, as well as natural supplements. The antioxidants are any molecular substance that reduces oxidative damage caused by free radicals. What do you want to do to be healthy in life, to live a longer life? You want to reduce inflammation. Inflammation to the brain, the heart, the arteries, the lungs, the muscles. All that helps you. That's the foundation of all preventative health care. So what are free radicals? Free radicals are highly reactive and unstable molecules that are produced either by the body, naturally, as a byproduct of oxidation, such as hydrogen peroxide, or toxins we are exposed to in the environment, pesticides, heavy metals, tobacco, smoke, asbestos, chemicals and household products, radiation from medical devices, ultraviolet light, and even some viruses are free radicals. These molecules and substances contain an unpaired electron in their outer atomic shell. And since they're unpaired, they're in a constant search to find another free electron to bind with. When free radicals find a partner in a cell, oxidation occurs. That's not good. One of the most common dangers is that free radicals will cause damage to our deep body's DNA. Now, although free radicals do not last long in the body, they nevertheless cause cellular damage by creating oxidative stress. Antioxidants, the superheroes, that are high in ORAC are a defense mechanism against free radicals' oxidative stress. ORAC improves our resistance to everything we wouldn't want in our body. It counters inflammation, boosts immunity. It's a superstar. The USDA recommends that we get about 3,000 or so ORAC units a day. Good luck with that. The studies show that we only get about 1,200 units daily. But to reach the recommended daily amount requires eating a huge amount of vegetables and fruits, etc. Let me give you an example. When you're eating lettuce, you're getting 5 units. A carrot is 10 units. A potato is 15 units. A grapefruit is 24 units. A half a cup of broccoli is 450 units. Fortunately, fresh foods can be condensed to provide higher concentrations of ORAC in a single serving to meet and surpass the daily recommendation. So just imagine, It's good to eat a healthy plant-based diet, and you should. That's what I do. But also every morning, now, I make sure that I take one scoop of my new natural-sourced Supreme Health Formula, or Supremacy, and I put it into a drink. So let's say if I had grapefruit juice, I'd be getting 24 ORAC. I get 11,000. Let me repeat that. 11,000 ORAC with each serving. Talking about going to the top of the list of what you could do to help yourself every day. So you're getting about 840 milligrams of vitamin C, which is fine. I just had two servings today. So I'm up at a good way to start the day. But I've got already 22,000 ORAC in my body. And that's what's important. That's stimulating the antioxidants to pair with those free radicals and neutralize them. So today, you think you're doing good for your body by having a potato, good, and a whole grain, good, and you maybe have 50 to 75 ORAC. I'm going to have 20 to 30,000 ORAC. Which body's going to be helped the most to turn off inflammation before it starts, or help it if it started? So when I say that this is a breakthrough product that will set a whole new standard. Remember, there's a company now doing a lot of advertising with their green and fruit capsules, etc. And good for them. I'm sure it's a good product. But I created that back in the 1980s. I was the first to do green stuff, red stuff, Power Berry Blast, etc. So I created the science on that. But I wasn't out to make money. I didn't. I just had a little company, small boutique company, but just making the finest products in the world. So here we are today with what is arguably a breakthrough product, because this puts everyone else to shame when it comes to the ORAC. So if you want to get yours, call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, until supplies last. I've already put in a reorder because of all the supply problems. I'm trying to get as much as I can, and so I pretty much we'll sell out of this one probably in the next week or two, and then we'll have to wait a while, but not as long as we did before. It was held up in shipping for almost 6 months. So we've got something unique. We have something that really, really is important for your body. High ORAC, 11,000 units per serving from the best sources. Amla, look up Amla. Look up Kakatoo Plum. Look up Kamu Kamu. Look them up. See for yourself. Then you understand the science behind this. Call Neil at the Vitamin Closet. Go in and visit him Monday to Saturday, noon to 8, or call him at 646-926-5430. 646-926-5430. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you for listening and watching. Have a nice day.